Hi there, Johnny B with CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg here. As we continue our Manitoba Birds series, today I'm excited to narrate an interview that I got to do with Jim Duncan about his work with Discover Owls, a local nonprofit run by him and his wife Patsy. Discover Owls seeks to improve the welfare of owls in Manitoba through focusing on research, education, and conservation. Through his research, as well as supporting students in their own studies, he's had the chance to work with all kinds of owls and has a wealth of information that he's eager to share. I had the pleasure of joining him at his beautiful property in the Interlake, where we sat down to talk about the work he's done, the work he's doing, and the questions that are still keeping him going in the field. It was a lovely late June day on the porch, and you'll get to hear wrens, goldfinches, jays, and robins, and many more in the background of the conversation. So without further ado, let's get into it. So has your research always centered around owls, or has you done other birds or animals in your career?
We've certainly done other birds and animals, and even sometimes some plants. During my career as a wildlife biologist, but I would say the meat and potatoes, or the core, or the passion, has certainly always been there for studying owls.
Now, there's about a dozen different owls that live and breed in Manitoba. Do you study all of them sort of broadly, or are there a few that you narrow in on?
Our studies have ranged from kind of broad, sweeping research on, for example, the causes of mortality of all the owls in Manitoba, and that produced a neat kind of summary. But some of our more focused research has been on primarily the great gray owl, Manitoba's official provincial bird, northern hawk owl, and more recently some species like the barred owl have been some pretty intense focus. And then a short foray into studying long-eared owls at one nest in 2015 that was really interesting.
So you mentioned studying mortality around owls. I think it was last summer sort of made big waves in the birding world, where research was coming out showing that I think there was something like 3 billion less birds in the world now than there was in the 70s. Have you noticed dips like that with owls? Obviously not all birds are affected equally by that, but in terms of how long you've been researching owls, has there been a big drop in numbers in Manitoba?
For some species, there appears to have been a decline over time, and that would include species like the short-eared owl, which is a grassland nesting owl, nests on top of the ground in tall grass, and also nests up in the Arctic. But a proportion of the population depends on grasslands, which have been experiencing habitat loss and degradation for some time now. Then the burrowing owl is another endangered owl in Manitoba. And at one point, we were quite convinced they were extirpated from the province. So they were alive somewhere else, but not in Manitoba. But they've made a bit of a comeback, and that's thanks to a researcher, Alex Fries, and her co-workers, who have pioneered some pretty interesting release recovery techniques. So I think there's a bit of hope there. And also, there's some really significant partnerships with agricultural producers, especially beef cattle producers, who have really, you know, showed some leadership in terms of helping conserve habitats that would benefit some of these species, both burrowing owls and also short-eared owls. So the other owls, they appear to be doing well. The reason we know that is because of a citizen science volunteer nocturnal owl survey that started in this kitchen right behind us in 1991, Patsy and I started it, and it's been ongoing ever since. And it's provided some significant data on the owl population trends. And so we're just starting to analyze that data. And one of the few species that actually showed an increase was long-eared owls.
Really great to hear. And obviously with things like eBird, citizen science and bird watching is becoming more accessible and more people are getting into it. Now, do you know, I often hear sort of a debate around, like, are there more species, or are there more numbers because we have this data, or is it because there's more people out there looking for it? Have there been greater numbers of people doing the nocturnal owl surveys over the years? Does that play into that at all?
Yeah, actually, at one point when we, I wouldn't say we were getting bored of looking at all the owl data, because it's just so exciting to see it and to play with it and to examine it. But at one point I was giving a talk at the University of Manitoba about the owl survey data. And I kind of said to the class, well, it's great that we know all the stuff about owls, but, you know, who's actually doing these surveys and why are they doing them? I said, it would be fascinating if one of you bright students kind of took up the flagpole and charged ahead and actually studied the people studying owls. And so, much to my delight, the professor contacted me and said, oh yeah, I've got a student, Chris Nigg, who's interested in helping with that aspect. So they did it as a senior undergrad project, and we ended up publishing a paper on the volunteers who contribute. And certainly the numbers of volunteers increased over the first number of years, but then it kind of reached a plateau and it kind of oscillated or fluctuated at a certain level. So we, over the, at least at the period of time that we studied, we had well over 900 people volunteer on the survey. Not every year, but there were some people who did it every year and some people who did it for a few years and for a variety of reasons stopped. But we, in any kind of research like that, there's ways to control for the effort or the number of people. And so that was a really important aspect of our analysis of the owl data, was to account for the variation in observers. And that's true for other things like Christmas bird counts, breeding bird surveys, breeding bird atlases. And so there are methods, and I assume there would be similar methods with eBird data, where you can account for how many people are actually helping to contribute data and adjust for that. So that's an important aspect. Even though there are more people looking, we can still get some really good data trends from these citizen science projects.
That's neat to have that insight into that. Now, you mentioned mainly your focus is on great grays, northern hawk owls, and barred owls. Are there specific challenges or interesting things with each of those species that comes with studying them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for the great gray, for example, we just finished up a nesting season. And where these birds choose to nest are really beautiful habitats, but they're also amazing habitats for mosquito production. And so the owls typically nest earlier than the mosquito hatch, which is really smart on their part, I think. But some years they, for whatever reason, they nest a little bit later. And that results in us, finishing up our field work with lots of mosquitoes. And it not only is kind of challenging for us, you feel like a human pincushion at some point, but it's also challenging for the owls when that happens, because the young are in the nest sometimes when the mosquitoes hatch and they have no escape. Older chicks and adults can perch up and high in trees and pick areas that with reduced mosquito exposure, but the chicks or the adult female in the nest late in the year, they can be hammered by mosquitoes. And we've had some years where very few chicks were actually fledged or survived the nestling period because the mosquitoes pretty much drain them from blood. And so that's a challenge, but also a really interesting habitat. So the barred owl is a large owl closely related to the great gray, and it nests in tree cavities, and it's a big owl, so it needs big trees and big cavities. But they're also notoriously secretive, and they do not want to reveal where they're nesting. And they've evolved over many thousands of years to avoid detection. So finding where they nest is challenging. And I worked with a really energetic, bright young grad student a number of years ago, Todd Wicklow. And he and I, over 2 years in the course of his master's degree program, we located 9 nests. And that was from 65 territories, roughly. So it takes a huge effort to find these nests. And but he did a great thesis, and we published about 4 papers on the breeding biology of barred owls in Manitoba. And prior to our work, there was only one nest ever found and described in the province, even though the owls are fairly common. They're detected every year on the owl surveys, but they're really good at keeping their secrets. And since then, I think we're up to about 20 nest sites so far. So our studies have been really ongoing, but continue to be challenging. But that's part of the fun. And then the northern hawk owl, it's a widespread species, but it doesn't occur at high densities. And some years, some winters especially, you will be hard pressed to find any. In other years, you'll find a lot. So it's hard for, say, a graduate student who has to do a degree in 2 years. They've got to pick the right years or be very lucky. So that's where some long-term research, like what we do, not dependent on a short research period at a university, that's where we can gain some valuable insights. But it's the long game. You got to be patient, and the data accumulates over the years. So I think we've banded about a total of 600 hawk owls compared to about 2,000 great grays, for example.
Now, owls are obviously raptors. Have you ever had any experience getting your nest and having being like dive bombed or parents coming after you? Is that a thing that owls do if you get close to the nest? And should even ask like, are you going into the nest often when there are eggs and chicks?
Yeah, we do. And yeah, you've described them quite aptly. They're really vigorous in their defense of nests, especially young eggs, less so. But as the young get older, they get more and more aggressive at defending their offspring, which is good. So we are certainly concerned for ourselves, but we're also concerned for the welfare of the birds. And I know in some parts of the world, people put on motorcycle helmets before they climb a tree to check or ban the nestlings. We never do that because we're more worried about the owl hurting itself if it does come at us, and they tend to go for the head. We don't want it hitting the motorcycle helmet and hurting itself. So we sometimes wear a thick jacket with a hood, and also we always have someone spotting so they can warn the person climbing the tree that the owl's coming in for an attack. And then you hug the tree really tight and you wave your arm at the last minute, and almost always the owl veers away. But the main goal is to get in there, do what you need to do, and get out as quickly as possible, again, to minimize the disturbance to the owls. But I'll tell you a short, I think, a really illuminating and funny story. Often, guidelines for owl surveys tell you never play the biggest owl calls first. Like a great horned owl, which has I think it's one of the most common owls we have in Manitoba, and it's got a booming voice like a whoo. And so they say never play the great horned owl call first if you're doing surveys, because big owls eat little owls, like smaller owls. And so we were surveying down in southeast Manitoba one spring, and we heard a solid owl calling. And that's another second most common owl in Manitoba, and it's got quite a distinct call, so it has more of a whistle, like a. So there's this little solid owl male singing his heart out, and Patsy and I were there, and I said to her, I said, "Gee, I wonder if we imitate a great horned owl call, if the solid owl will be intimidated and nervous and stop calling." So while the solid owl was calling, I imitated the call of the great horned owl. And instantly, the solid owl stopped calling. So I turned around to Patsy and I said, "Wow, I guess those recommendations on how to survey were right." And about 2 seconds later, after I said that, the solid owl hit my head, took my wool hat right off, because it was early spring, it was cold, took my hat right off my head. So in the end, we thought, okay, well, maybe it wasn't so intimidated after all. So it's a little owl with really big attitude. So.
That's really interesting. But I've also heard you talk recently, and I guess this speaks to technology changing how research is done, but you've started incorporating drones into your nest research. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I wouldn't say I was avoiding it for years and years, but I honestly never thought it would be that practical. And an opportunity came up with some of the funds that we raised through Discover Owls, giving talks and whatnot, to purchase a drone. And so we started to experiment with it. because when we, you know, approached the province to get permission to add this as part of our research methods, they said, well, there was no data available on the effect of the use of drones on nesting owls. So we said, well, why don't we start, do a study and actually measure that at the same time as we assess the effectiveness or usefulness of that. So we did it, and as we approached an owl nest, normally what we would do is walk, this is a great graze, the main focus, we would walk up to the nest, climb it, check the contents, climb down, and then leave. So that takes a certain amount of time, and the owls fly off the nest, and you're also potentially leaving your scent, if you're not careful, on the trail to the nest, climbing up the tree, a scent that mammalian predators like black bear, fisher, could follow. So we're always careful to try to minimize the scent. Anyhow, with the drone, you have the opportunity to fly up from a distance from the nest, inspect the nest cavity, count the eggs or young, age them, and then fly the drone back and minimize disturbance. So what we found with the great grays is that they actually stay on the nest until the drone is within about 15, 20 feet or, you know, three or four meters. And then they fly off the drone. You can navigate pretty close. The owls don't attack it, which is another good thing. You don't want the owls getting hurt attacking the drone. Then we can back it off. And once the drone is starting to fly back to us, the owls return pretty quickly, which is great because the nest is not exposed to ravens or hawks that might come in and take an egg or young. So it seems like it's very useful, and especially for really tall nest structures. Owls don't make their own nests, so they're typically, for great grays, it's stick nests in tall trees. And some of these trees are well over 50, 60 feet. So as I age, it's also an important tool, because if you fell from 50, 60 feet, you don't heal as fast as you do when you're 20. So I would say for that species, it's working well. Ravens, we tried, and I think that they are much more sensitive to the drone approach, and they leave the nest earlier and take a lot longer to come back. So we quickly stopped doing that. We tested it on a great horned owl nest, only one, and it showed a similar reaction to the great gray. So it could be potential use for that species as well. So I think it has a future, that would benefit the owls and researchers.
That's really neat. You also have a couple of owl roommates here on your property. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Sure. They're wonderful individuals. Rusty is a female long-eared owl, and she was provided to us. She was confiscated. Somebody had her illegally as a very young bird, because owls leave the nest before they fly, and sometimes people find them on the ground. They look fluffy and they look abandoned and orphaned, but almost always they're not. And she was irreversibly imprinted, and so we use her for education and research. The education part, she's comfortable going into a classroom on her basket perch, which is her home away from home. So we can demonstrate a lot of interesting owl behavior by having her perform. She does certain activities in the classroom, but culminates with a flight around the room where she flies over the heads of students or adults, of course silently, so they get to experience silent flight. And the good news is she doesn't go to the bathroom when she flies. And she's only ever landed on someone's head once, and that was a really tall adult who wasn't sitting down. So it's a wonderful way to for people to get up close and personal with owls and learn a lot about them. And the other owl we have is a similar story. She's a human imprint, and so she thinks she's human, and that's a great gray owl named Oska. And the two of them tag team. They take turns going doing public education talks or talks in schools, and so they're wonderful ambassadors. Some of the research we do with them are on their vocalizations, because their calls are instinctive. They don't learn them from the adults when they're growing up. So the long-eared owl also provides molted feathers, which we tag, date, and examine the pattern of molt, of how they replace their feathers over the course of the spring and summer. which is data it's really hard to get from a wild bird where you might encounter it once when you catch and band it. And it takes a lot of energy to grow feathers. And years when they don't have a lot of food, they won't replace as many feathers. Or if they're having a large brood they're reproducing, they kind of have to decide, are they going to put energy from the food they catch into growing young or growing feathers? And same with the great gray. So it's those are great opportunities to learn from these two birds.
Now, is there any, because I guess their lives here are not particularly, I don't know if stressful is the right way to do it, but you know, they have a safe home here and they don't have to make those decisions. Does that affect that data at all?
Absolutely. They more or less get all the food they want, but I also make sure they don't get overweight. That's important. So they need exercise and they need a kind of not be overfed. But that said, they do not have to make that decision. You're right. So they're able to replace more feathers than, say, a breeding bird would. And we've got molt data from single captures of many, many different wild great gray owls from all times of the year. Same with, not so much with long-eared owls. And so what we're seeing with the molt of these captive birds is probably the optimum molt if an owl is not reproducing in the wild. It'd be similar to that. But we're, some of the patterns that we're getting are really interesting. So there's the molt starts at different points in the wing, for example, and it radiates in both directions from there. And it progresses in a manner that allows the owl to continue to fly while it's molting, which is really important. It's very different from ducks, which molt all the wing feathers, and then they have to find a big water body where they can be safe to grow until they grow all their feathers back. And the other neat thing that we can't explain is that a particular feather on, say, the right wing will molt on, say, June 5th. And then, even though they're captive and they're getting fed all they want or need, that feather will not molt the next year. But the following year, it will molt, and it'll molt on June 5th or June 6th. So it'll molt on the same day, you know, over a two-year period. And how that happens, like, there must be some genetic clock that programs that feather to drop on a certain day, more than 1 year apart. So I find that fascinating. I don't know how that works, but I'm really hoping that a bright young scientist will come along one day and figure that out for us. But we'll have the data to kind of maybe stir them on.
Yeah, and that's interesting data that you'll never get in the wild, you know, to get that feather on that day 2 years apart. So sort of an interesting question. Like, I have trouble sometimes finding a cat sitter when I'm heading out for the weekend or, you know, going traveling or whatever. What is it like for you when you're away? What do these owls do?
Well, they're pretty low maintenance, so it's pretty easy either to it's actually easier to get somebody to either stay at our house, and if they are staying at the house, watching the house for us, then all they have to do is in the morning take out, you know, one mouse for the long-eared owl and three mice for the great gray, thaw them out, and then feed them just before sunset. And they can do that by just opening the pen and putting them on a shelf in there. And so that's pretty much it. They've got a bath. They don't really need to drink water. They get the water from their food. And so that part's pretty easy, as long as you're not squeamish about handling frozen dead mice. And in the past, sometimes we've asked different other facilities or other people who have knowledge on how to care for raptors to look after them at their place. So Parkland Mews, that Rob and Nancy Wilden, they've helped us in the past by looking after owls, and same with the University of Manitoba. But we found it's pretty easy. Some people get pretty excited when they house sit and have to, you know, take care of a couple of owls. So
yeah,
it's pretty neat.
Unique opportunity.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about or ask you about the, like, Discover Owls, the program that you and your wife Patsy run. Obviously, you've done a ton of research, but research in and of itself is just sort of information without action following that up. Do you have any stories of your research getting put into conservation action that you're aware of?
Yeah, we started out, I guess, studying owls for a university degree. And after that, it was something that I felt was had become such an important part of our lives, almost like a lifestyle. So I can remember my first job interview, and one of the questions they asked was, well, what would prevent you from taking this job? And I said, I couldn't believe I said it because I was, Patsy was pregnant. We were really needing to get a job to start earning our way through the world. And I said to them, well, I wouldn't take this job if you didn't let me continue some of our owl studies as part of the paid work. And this was in a different province from Manitoba at the time. And much to my surprise and delight, they said, sure. So we were able, so every single job I've had after that, I've always negotiated continuing to do some of our long-term research as part of that job. But that doesn't really answer your question. There's been a continuity of our research, and it's given us, an understanding and a maturity of being able to bring that research to the table, whether we're meeting with forest companies, mining companies, conservation groups like Nature Conservancy Canada, Ducks Unlimited Canada, where we can provide some of that insight into planning early on to either enhance how protected areas may benefit owl species, but also other biodiversity, and also how development can occur in a way that's sustainable or that minimizes the impact. An example of that was forestry. You know, forestry used to be done with larger blocks of straight-edged cuts. And those straight-edged cuts presented a problem because species like the great gray owl like to perch on edges to hunt. And if you have a long linear edge that you rarely find in nature, other predators of great gray owls, like great horned owls, could see a great gray hunting at quite a distance. And the great gray is so focused on catching something that the great horned owl could fly down that straight line and kill it. So we modified recommended forest management practices to include a lot of curvy edges to the cuts, so it breaks up the line of sight. And that has been found to be important for moose conservation as well. Also retaining trees in the middle of a cutover area where the cutover areas are bigger than 50 meters across. That provides perches for hunting owls like hawk owls. And so a few minor tweaks can actually enhance habitat through forest management for certain owl species. I mean, you certainly need a diversity of management techniques to address all the biodiversity needs, but it's helped there. So Discover Owls was set up pretty much to continue on some of the work we were doing when I was employed in my retirement. And there's essentially three legs to the stool. One is research, for sure, which is important. Education, I think, is equally important, because you can publish all the scientific papers you want, but if 50 people in the world read one of your published papers, that's success. But how do you get that information into the public? How do you make owls a personal part of people's lives so they start to know and care about them more? That's where the education part comes in. That's why we take the effort to bring live owl into a school or a meeting or a group and do presentations. We've done over 470 of them so far. And I estimate about 25 to 30,000 people have participated in the programs. And so we also ask for donations to Discover Owls for those talks, and that money fuels and funds the research program. But there's a third leg, that's conservation, where that information has to be put into practice. So we've done that in a number of ways. I've mentioned one with the forest management guidelines. We've also contributed money to owl festivals around the world, one in Nepal, some in India, where these festivals kind of go out into the communities in rural areas, and they help to inspire people, educate people, but also help people understand that some of their activities might be impacting owls, like cutting down trees or gathering eggs for having a bit more luck If you have a fresh owl egg in your pocket and you go to gamble in some places around the world, it used to be that they thought that was important, so that impacted owl nests. And those festivals really got to adults through their kids. So if you can inspire kids, then they can help change the behavior of adults. So that was pretty neat. So that's, I guess, the philosophy behind Discover Owls.
That's really neat to see the global outreach of that. Now, I understand you've also done a fair bit of traveling with your owl research and presentations and stuff like that. Have you ever come across research that other folks have done outside of Canada that has either inspired you here or made you think a little differently about the research that you do?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the benefits of attending scientific conferences. And, you know, we actually started off a series of World Owl Conferences here in Manitoba in Winnipeg in 1987. And that was a Northern Forest Owl Symposium, ran for a few days out of the Viscount Gort Hotel. And that was a lot of fun. And that information exchange proved so valuable that people were interested in having a second one. So we had a second one here in Winnipeg in 1997. And then at that meeting, we all agreed that we should have this thing move around the world. And the next spot it was recommended was in the Southern Hemisphere, because there was some of our analysis collectively by all the people attending was that owls were relatively unresearched or relatively poorly known in the Southern Hemisphere. So the next meeting was in Canberra. We didn't go to that one, but one of our students here in Manitoba, Heather Heinem, at the time was a master's student I supervised, and we packed her off. She went to her first conference ever down in Australia. And so that was a neat one. And each of these conferences produces a proceeding, so a bunch of papers from the meeting. And they can range from topics from education, research on owls, to conservation. And then after that, it ended up being in the Netherlands, and after that in Portugal, and then after that in India. So we've had a few of them around the different parts of the world. And some of the information gained that was inspiring was not only the new technologies that are emerging, like smaller and smaller little backpack transmitters that can relay the location of the owls to a satellite and back. That's expanding our knowledge on how owls move around the landscape. DNA analysis, genetic analysis, that's telling us more and more about how many species of owls there are in the world. And essentially the number of owls that we have defined, number of species, has actually grown because of our enhanced knowledge of their songs or DNA. I just think overall those conferences are great opportunities to exchange information and also to develop relationships and colleagues and friendships that really transcend political boundaries or philosophies or religions. So.
So you mentioned the first one is 87, the second one is 97. It sounds like they're happening more often now. Is this a thing that's, and maybe COVID interrupted this a little bit, but are they happening with a schedule regularly, or is this like a every other year kind of thing? Or
yeah, no, it was certainly 10 years between the first two, and the intervals seem to have gotten irregularly smaller. But we're not sure if that's an artifact of a lot of us getting older. We don't know if we can wait 10 years to the next one. But the one in India was in 2019. And that was like the last one before the pandemic hit. And then the next one is 2023 in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Oh, neat. So, yeah. Yeah, and is that an event that is open to the public, or is that sort of specifically geared towards academics and researchers?
Well, certainly anybody can register and attend the conference. Many of the conferences, I think perhaps all of them, if nothing else, have had at least part of the event be open to the general public without a registration fee. So for example, in Winnipeg, we had owl art contests or exhibits, and that was open to the public. If you wanted to attend the presentations, then you could either buy a day pass to register or the whole conference package. There was also field trips associated with these conferences, so that people visiting These countries could actually get out and experience owl habitats in those local areas with people who were very familiar with the habitats and biodiversity and owls there. And there's usually also an education component. So the one in India, for example, right on the heels of the owl conference, there was a two-day owl festival in a rural community that was absolutely fascinating to watch and talk to people who, you know, some people's jobs in these rural communities were to, whenever there was a snake, poisonous snake sighting, their job was to go in and be very carefully, humanely capture the snake and relocate it so they wouldn't be harmed. I mean, not owl related, but it was neat to see those kinds of programs in places like that.
Okay, so now you've obviously done decades of research, and as every scientist knows, with everything you discover or uncover, you unearth another like 10, 20, 100 questions that result from that. What are the questions you're asking yourself now or looking into now or hoping that the next generation will start asking based on the research that you've done?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of these questions, they either come up, you know, recently, or they've been bubbling around in your head, kind of like a itch that needs scratching. And one of them was early on when I was starting to study great gray owls, was it's quite fascinating that these birds can locate, capture prey, and their main prey are a type of mouse called a field vole. And these voles are active all winter, but they never come up to this, or rarely come up to the surface. So most of the winter they spend under thick snow cover. And most predators can't get them. That's why a lot of hawks migrate south in the winter. But the great grays actually get fatter over the winter. And we know that from catching and banding them. And so watching them hunt is fascinating. And Manitoba is one of the best places in the world for people to drive a short distance from Winnipeg. And or if you live out in rural areas, finding areas where these owls hunt. And you watch them hunt and they're perched 20, 30 feet up in a tree on the edge of a open field, and they fly, you see them fly off their perch, they go out and they dive into the snow, and sometimes almost disappearing completely in the snow. So they're locating by hearing these voles under the snow without seeing them. Well, they catch them under up to 45 centimeters snow thickness. And so how they locate them, is, I think, is quite fascinating. And I've always wondered what effect the snow has on sound, because if you've ever tunneled into a snowbank as a kid or built a fort as an adult, gone in underneath the snow, you know that it gets really quiet in there, so it really muffles the sound. So I've always wanted to figure out what sounds voles are making under the snow, what effect the snow cover has on the sounds, and how do the owls locate it, because it's such a weak sound. And so we're starting to explore that. We had a researcher come up to Manitoba from California this last February, and he had this amazing thing called a sound camera. So it's a small camera lens in the middle of a big board, and all the board, all around the camera lens, is an array in a spiral pattern of microphones, and the camera records the video image but also the sound, and superimposes the sound as color on this, what you see. So you're visualizing the sound. And we did experiments by altering the frequency of sound and measuring the density and thickness of snow cover. And we discovered that only very low frequencies actually make it through the sound, through the snow. And so there's a attenuation of sound that occurs, but also there's refraction. So much like when you're in a boat and you're looking at a fish in the water, because water refracts light rays, where you see the fish is not where the fish is, essentially, because the waters were bending the light. Well, it turns out snow bends sound, because snow was frozen water, I guess. That may be part of the explanation. But so where the owl hears the vole is not where the vole is, if it's at an angle. Mm-hmm. So the owls, we're now studying the owl's hunting behavior, and they essentially have to fly out and hover right over the vole, so they get rid of that error, that refraction error, and then they go straight down. And so that part's been fascinating. We're going to do some more measurements of snow around where the owls are catching voles. And so that's kind of exciting and new. And, you know, after 30 years of having that question kind of like an itch in my brain. It's finally getting scratched with help from people like this researcher, Chris from California. And so we're about to publish a paper on that. And the next steps would be studying how the big facial discs of owls, which is a big round circle of feathers surrounding the face, and that acts like a giant sound funnel. So it focuses sounds into the ear. And we know that it helps increase the volume of sound. And so what we want to do is actually measure how much it does that. So we're going to be doing that by putting little microphones in the ears of dead owl heads and measuring. It sounds gruesome. It is kind of, but it's going to be a great way to quantify, you know, what kind of a magnification effect that facial disc has on these weak sounds coming up from the ground.
Amazing. I mean, that's, yeah, endlessly fascinating things to research. Well, I think it won't take any more of your time. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
You could chat with Jim for hours and hours and continue learning interesting facts and anecdotes about the work he's done with owls. But unfortunately, that's all the time that I have for today. The good news for you is that Jim is available and eager to come do public talks about owls, and you might even get the chance to meet Rusty the long-eared education owl or Oscar the great gray. If you're part of a school, a community center, or workplace that would like to have him out, check out discoverowls.ca for more information. Also, the International Festival of Owls that he mentioned is coming up in March 2023 and is less than a 10-hour drive away from Winnipeg in La Crosse, Wisconsin. So see you there, maybe? Thanks for tuning in to this installment of the Manitoba Bird Series. I've been your host, Johnny B. And if you've got any questions, comments, or suggestions about this program, please get in touch. You can reach me at whatsupckuw@gmail.com. Till next time.